Welcome back to Yahoo Finance. Well, NFTs keep gaining in popularity, and the latest pairs the allure of a designer Hermès Birkin out of reach to mere mortals, tying them into the digital art space. Here to discuss is the artist behind the Meta Birkin. His name is Mason Rothschild, Meta Birkin's NFT series artist. Thank you so much for being with us, Mason, and congratulations, because it seems like it's been quite the hit. And I want to just provide some context and some numbers as well. So the first Meta Birkin sold for about 10 Ethereum. There's so much price volatility, but let's say it sold for above $40,000. And in 5 days, about 600,000 in volume sold. The cheapest listed Meta Birkin is now about $13,500, on par with one of the lower end of an Hermès Birkin bag, I guess. So this isn't your first foray into Birkin art. What is the attraction for you and for the buyer?
I mean, for me, there's nothing more iconic than the Hermès Birkin bag. And I wanted to kind of see as an experiment to see if I could create that same kind of illusion that it has in real life as a digital commodity. And I feel like I've kind of accomplished that with the statistics that we kind of have today, is being able to put together this kind of digital commodity that everybody loves, bringing it into the digital world with this introduction of the metaverse, and seeing how it works out and how it plays in the hands of like the community, selling it at that, keeping that scarcity of 100 bags total, and seeing what the community does with it. Because I feel like there's nothing stronger in this NFT space than community and being able to garner the attention of people and build that relationship with the consumer and being able to bring it forward and keep pushing. And the support has been crazy.
It really has been crazy. And you know, you talk about trying to build that relationship with the community via the metaverse. We're looking at the bags right now. They're pretty incredible. Talk to me about the inspiration for doing this with fur. That's fur that you see around these bags. And I know you also did the one where there was a pregnant Hermès Birkin bag where it was giving, you were able to see a little baby inside the bag. That sold for over $23,000 in May.
Yeah, it actually just resold to a collector 2 days ago for $42,000. That one is a collector in the metaverse called Solaverse is actually putting them together and putting an auction together in their like metaverse gallery. So that one just resold. But for this one, I wanted to kind of like, I come from the fashion industry, you know, just working from the retail aspect in Saint Laurent and Dior. And with Caring Group's like recent initiatives to go fur free and, you know, kind of be a little bit more sustainable in the future, I kind of wanted to bring a little bit of irony to the situation and make these, you know, Meta Birkins out of fur as that fur free initiative, since it's not, you know, doing anything for, you know, animals or anything like that. It's actually just digital simulated fur. So it's kind of like a play on that. The baby Birkin, like you alluded to, was kind of a play on the words baby and Birkin, which is like the most sought after Birkin size. So I decided to put a baby in a Birkin and go through all stages of pregnancy in there. You know, I'm really using it as kind of just artistic representation of like what goes on in my head.
How surprised are you by the reaction that these bags have been getting? Because everyone and his brother and sister want to get into the NFT space. The latest one is Beyonce saying, you know, NFTs are the wave of the future. Do you think that it's overblown a little bit? How surprised are you by the reaction? Because, you know, there are some out there that say, I had this conversation with my daughter, for example, and she says, no way would I spend that kind of money for, you know, digital art of a Birkin. What am I going to do? I want to hold it. I want to feel it. I want to walk around with it.
My thing is that with this introduction of the metaverse, you know, like we all already live in kind of our phones and everything. And this introduction of like Web3 and the metaverse is allowing us to actually own these commodities in this place where we can actually show them off. I was explaining to somebody before, there's not much difference in between, you know, having the crazy car or the crazy handbag in real life, because it's kind of just that showing of like wealth or that kind of explanation of success. And now you're able to bring that into the metaverse with these iconic NFTs that have fetched, you know, crazy amounts of money in that resale market for NFTs. So I feel like the difference between the two is like getting a little bit blurred now, because we have this new outlet, which is the metaverse, to showcase our product, showcase them in our like virtual worlds, and even just show them online. You know, like people have been posting the ones that they've gotten, and people kind of like have this hype around them that like, oh, wow, you were able to secure one of those.
And real quick here, Mason, I know that when you're talking about high-end luxury items like an Hermes bag, counterfeiting happens all over the place. Are you concerned as the artist that you're going to start getting that happening here, even though they do say blockchain's, you know, going to keep it all on the up and up? But do you have to look out for counterfeiting, you know, in the NFT space?
100%. Actually, like before my collection dropped, there was a bunch of like counterfeit NFTs that weren't from my collection. We're in the process of like verifying mine on OpenSea. But we had like $35,000, $40,000 in volume of people buying fake versions of my Meta Birkin. So yeah, like counterfeits are definitely there. I'm hoping that these platforms have more of a connection with the artist moving forward, so, you know, they don't lose out on that kind of hype and people don't get scammed and end up spending, you know, $40,000 on a fake.
All right. Well, Mason Rothschild, we are so excited for you and so pleased to have you on the show. Congratulations with all the success. Meta Birkin's NFT series artist, and we can't wait to see what comes next.
We're expecting some fireworks on Capitol Hill kicking off in about 10 minutes as executives from FTX, Circle, Coinbase, other major crypto firms all face the House Financial Services Committee to answer questions from lawmakers about the state of the asset class. Let's get a little bit more of a pulse on this from Kai Sheffield, head of crypto at Visa, who's live with us alongside Yahoo Finance's David Hollerith, who's going to be joining for the conversation as well. Kai, it's great to have you on the show. I want to talk a little bit about Visa's new advisory business as well, but I kind of want to kick off with the news du jour with that big hearing on Capitol Hill. You know, the pulse in Washington appears to be an acknowledgement that crypto is inevitable. So it's just the question of what is the proper way to regulate it. What are you expecting out of that hearing today? Would you expect it to be contentious, friendly? What do you think the tone is going to be?
Yeah, it's hard to predict the tone, but it's very clear that crypto is top of mind for policymakers and regulators across the world. And we've been tracking these developments, you know, very closely. And I think what we're seeing is there is clear consumer demand, and there's a ton of in this ecosystem that, you know, is really driving payments and financial services forward. The question is really, how can you mitigate risk and protect consumers? And so we think it's really important to have hearings and to be able to have engagement between the public and private sector, because the space moves so quickly that it's really hard to understand all the aspects of it. So we're really interested to see, you know, how this hearing goes today and to have further engagement in the future.
Yeah, and Kai, obviously Visa's been shipping a ton of crypto products this year, and now you're launching a crypto advisory service. Can you sort of just explain that and how that is playing into Visa's strategy?
Yeah, sure. So over the past 3 years, we've really become a bridge between crypto platforms and our global network of 80 million merchants across the world. So we've partnered with, you know, over 60 crypto wallets and exchanges, you know, the market leaders like Coinbase and FTX and Crypto.com, and help them offer their own Visa card programs. And, you know, now what we've seen over that time is the volume of inbound calls that we've gotten from our existing clients, from large banks, has skyrocketed. And so we're really focused on how can we also become a bridge between these financial institutions and the crypto ecosystem. And we're seeing more and more interest in activity with banks looking to participate. And we think Visa is really well positioned to help advise them on how they can start to interact with this ecosystem.
Hey, Kai, it's Julie here. So let's bring these two things together, the promise or threat, depending on how you look at it, of regulation and this advisory service that you guys are launching, because presumably that's going to be a part of your advising as well. If there is more regulatory scrutiny, for example, we had several crypto firms earlier in the year that had to pull back on lending products because of scrutiny from the SEC. So what is your sort of big thought bubble for some of these advisory clients when it comes to regulation?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is crypto can be so many different things. You know, you have crypto assets, you know, you have stable coins for payments, you have, you know, new financial services. And so it all depends on the use case. And we found that, you know, a lot of our clients, you know, a lot of banks, they haven't had full-time teams that have been tracking the ecosystem and understanding all the latest trends. And so it's really starting with educating them and showing kind of what's happening and what could that mean for the bank's business and what are ways that they could start to get involved. And it all depends on what the use case is based on what the regulatory environment, you know, says and how that will evolve over time.
And Kai, Visa is also working with central banks to issue central bank-backed digital currencies. And I was just curious, you know, you talked about that before, but sort of where are those partnerships and how does that play into the advisory role?
Yeah, so we've been engaging with dozens of central banks across the world on the topic of CBDC. And what we found is that, you know, central banks are moving from just research to looking to pilot, looking to explore and experiment. And there's a really important role for the private sector to play. You know, someone has to build and operate a CBDC wallet. You know, what does it actually look like as a product? How do consumers use it? And so what we've been doing is really focused on what is that consumer-facing design? What infrastructure will banks need to operate wallets? And I think banks, particularly, you know, in markets across the world where central banks have been very advanced on this, they don't want to wait until CBDC comes. You know, they want to have a plan. They want to have a strategy, and they want to figure out what a CBDC wallet would look like that the bank would offer to consumers. And so, you know, our engagements that we've been doing have been really helpful to then go back and partner with banks so that they can be well positioned as these initiatives evolve.
Hey, Kai, real quick, is the Federal Reserve one of them? Is there a Fed wallet coming?
We're working with central banks all across the world. I think in the United States, there's still a lot of open questions about what problem would a digital dollar solve? What would it actually look like? And, you know, we're seeing that there are digitized fiat currencies in the form of stablecoins that are growing rapidly. And so I think there's a lot that we can learn of what's happening in the private sector. And, you know, it's not clear today, and the Fed has said this, that there is a case for a central bank digital currency right now in the U.S.
All right. Well, I'll take that as a maybe. But Kai Sheffield, head of crypto at Visa, live with us. And again, Yahoo Finance's David Hollerith also here for that conversation. Thanks again.
Welcome back. Our next guest says Congress must continue to work to bring legal and regulatory certainty to technology such as cryptocurrencies so that entrepreneurs can flourish in the United States. Congressman Patrick McHenry joins us now. I should note, he's also a ranking member of the House Financial Services Committee, which received testimony from a whole lot of crypto heavyweights yesterday. Congressman, good to see you here. Is this one of the biggest risks as pertains to regulation, that regulation, when it comes out in any form, is too tough in that crypto entrepreneurs take their capital and move it outside of the country?
I don't think it's a question of tough or lax regulation. We currently have, as members of the House learned yesterday, we currently have a regulated space for cryptocurrencies in the United States. They're adhering to existing laws. What we have the risk of is poor regulation, bad regulation, dumb regulation that then drives this innovation somewhere else. We have a question of really whether or not the United States wants to be competitive in Web3. And if we want to be the innovators, we want to be leaders in the space like we were the leaders in the space in Web 1 and 2, we have to make sure that we embrace this technology and have a fulsome embrace of it at the federal level so that it can grow and flourish here and get all the benefits here at home.
Representative McHenry, it's Brian Chung here. Now, I think in the span of on the spectrum of House Financial Services hearings, yesterday's was pretty tame. It was a kind of a genuine fact-finding mission for both Democrats and Republicans and seemed like it could be a good starting ground for some sort of bipartisan approach to a regulatory framework around these things. What is the next actionable step? And I'm not talking about specific policies, but from a legislative standpoint, would this look like some sort of kind of wholesale framework like a Dodd-Frank that would kind of overarch everything here? What are the next steps for lawmakers now that you've already had the fact-finding from yesterday?
Well, look, we have a 13-year-old technology. 13 years after Satoshi wrote the Bitcoin white paper, Congress is having its first hearing on Bitcoin and blockchain technology. 13 years later, $3 trillion market cap. So one hearing should not bring about policy. We should have more hearings about this to understand to understand more deeply the nature of this technology and Web3. We had, in essence, two brokers, two technology creators, and two stable coins represented on a panel. That is a very, very modest representation of this new ecosystem. So I think we need more hearings, greater understanding of the nature of digital assets and its potential. And that's before we get into the question of what are the necessary next steps. And I don't think we need a full rewrite of laws. I think we need some modest changes to existing laws to make sure that they're tech neutral. And in that way, we can use the benefits of this new technology here in the United States and let them fit into let our regulators embrace these things in a proper way.
Congressman, I appreciate, it's Julie here, by the way, I appreciate your concern for wanting to do this properly. At the same time, what you're describing sounds like it's going to take a long time, right? And as you point out, it's already been 13 years. And so what's the level of urgency here? And what is the risk of waiting much longer to get some of these, whether it's expanded or new regulatory frameworks in place?
Well, first of all, everyone on that panel yesterday was adhering to current laws. And I think members of Congress were surprised to hear that there is serious regulation in this marketplace. Money transmission licenses in 50 states. We have the CFTC in one place. You have a method for ICOs with accredited investors through securities regulation. We have this layering on of adherence to existing laws. What we don't have, though, is a full embrace of the technology and regulations that are sort of with a forward-looking view and an embrace of this technology. We need to work on those things. So let me just tell you, for Congress to come in 13 years after this technology developed and have one hearing and then say we have all the answers is really bad, even for Congress. We need to make sure that we're deeply informed. And right now, we're policymakers on the Hill, by and large, are barely modestly informed. So we need to have a measured approach rather than a precipitous approach. I think a precipitous approach would harm innovation here in the United States rather than the measured approach that I think we should seek.
Now, I guess it is kind of unfair to say, all right, well, here's the regulatory approach to all of crypto, because there's just so many different corners. So then let me drill down specifically on stablecoins, where even the Biden administration appears to be a leg up above perhaps development of regulation on other corners of crypto. There was that President's Working Group report that kind of not specifically laid out any sort of policy recommendations, but at least they're thinking about it. In your view, is that kind of the first stepping stone, that there could be a piecemeal approach where you have some sort of stablecoin-specific approach to, say, for example, requiring these types of firms to have a bank charter or not have a bank charter or other types of prescriptions?
Yeah, I think stablecoins is the soft entry point here by which we can build consensus in a bipartisan way and create law. This is something that regulation alone cannot adapt and embrace. We need to have, at the federal level, we need to have changes in law in order for stablecoins to actually be in the marketplace. What we heard yesterday, though, is a great deal of skepticism on both sides of the aisle about the president's working group approach, which is to say only FDIC-insured institutions can issue stablecoins. There was skepticism by both parties on that account. I think there is a realization that stablecoins have different attributes. Some are a store of value, whether it's a savings account or a money market account. Others are a method of payment. So they look much more like a payments regulation regime. And so we have to make sure that we have law and regulation coming out of that new law that allows for optionality here at the federal level based on the nature of what will be done with that stable coin. Not all stable coins are made the same, but we need to make sure that they have appropriate capitalization and appropriate regulation for us to get the full benefit out of the entry point to Web3.
Congressman, finally, I have to ask, there are some of your fellow peers in Congress who are Bitcoin bulls, outspokenly so. I'm just curious if you own any of this stuff, if you own any crypto at all.
I don't. And my view here is that my work in public policy is focused on public policy and not personal gain and personal benefit. And so while I am bullish about digital assets in the space, I don't own any, nor do I participate in any trading of stocks otherwise, although I think people should have ownership in the marketplace. I am a federal employee and I have a federal retirement account, just like other federal employees, and they're broadly held instruments in that retirement account. So I'm a pretty boring guy, but I think this is an exciting space that we should adapt and embrace in a really fulsome way.
Yeah, you seem pretty cool to us. Congressman Patrick McHenry, good to see you. Have a great rest of the week. One of the biggest IPOs of 2021 has arrived. Brazilian digital bank Nu Holdings has raised $2.6 billion, valuing the company at a staggering $41 billion at its IPO price. That makes it the world's most valuable standalone digital bank. The company does business as Nubank in Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia, and was backed in June by Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett. Joining us now for more on the company is Nubank's founder and CEO, David Velez. David, good to see you. Congratulations on the debut. I know it's been a long time coming. For those not familiar with Nubank, set the scene for us in some of these countries you operate. What is it like for a consumer to do banking in some of these countries, and why are they coming to you?
Thank you. Listen, it's very painful. There is a lot of pain in consumer banking. A lot of these countries traditionally have had five banks that own 80 to 90% of all the investments, lending, credit, savings. So for a very long time, there were really no alternatives for consumers. They were basically at the mercy of the same five banks, which ultimately meant paying some of the highest fees in the world, some of the highest interest rates in the world. And then that's for the people that could actually open an account. Then you had other 40% of the population that were completely outside the system, which meant even more pain and a huge opportunity for entrepreneurship.
David, I imagine it was an exciting day back in June when Warren Buffett invested in your company. Did you get a chance to talk to him?
I did, yeah. I had the pleasure to meet him. I'm a big fan of him, always been. He's a phenomenal entrepreneur, phenomenal investor. So we were very proud of having him as an investor.
Is he still an investor now? And what did he tell you?
He asked some really good questions. He put me on the spot. And he had done the homework on the company, so we were very excited to have those conversations. And of course, he's along for the ride, so we're very happy.
David, it's Julie here. I want to ask about your customer base a little bit, because as you say, you are increasing accessibility to banking for your customers. I'm curious what some of the opportunities, but also some of the challenges might be with these customers. Presumably, I'm guessing, you correct me if I'm wrong, we're talking about smaller deposits perhaps per customer. So are you dependent on it sort of being a volume business, on you getting a lot of customers?
Yeah, I mean, scale is important. Obviously, to be able to have a lot of efficiency, to then pass that efficiency back to the end consumer via no fees and lower interest rates. So partly what we're trying to do here is scaling with a really, really good product. Culturally, we're a company that is consumer obsessed. We focus very much on that user experience, and consumers become our biggest ambassadors. They do all the branding for us. That translates into a customer acquisition that is one of the lowest CACs that we know of in the world, one of the highest net promoter scores that we know of in the world. And ultimately, that viral growth brings scale, which again, we can pass back to the consumer via better fees and interest. So, and this is both consumers that had bank accounts before, that are tired of dealing with those big banks, are coming to us, and then also a lot of consumers that had never really had access, that were putting their cash under the mattress and are excited to be able to invest well, to get a loan, to really deal with somebody that is thinking about them every day.
David, it's Brian Chung. If you're not in the banking business, you should sell jackets, because those jackets are pretty sweet. I want one. But I want to ask about
we'll get you one.
The focus group. I want to ask about the focus group. It's about capital. It's Now, where are the areas of focus? Because I think one attractive offering, I imagine, for your customers is perhaps cross-border payments, the ability to transact with other countries, for example. How do you feel that plays into the strategy going forward after this IPO?
Yeah. So we're still very focused in Brazil, which is our core market, expanding our entire portfolio. We started with credit card, then we launched a savings, lending, investments. We brought an investments platform that offer over 400 different investment funds to consumers in Brazil, and we're integrating that to our app. Then with credit, we also have 1.1 million small businesses and micro-entrepreneurs, and where we're starting to offer them more and more products. And very recently, we also opened our customer base for third-party financial and non-financial services partners. So, for example, we just added over 10 different e-commerces that can sell their e-commerce goods inside our platform. So for Brazil, we're very focused on that expansion. And then the other vector of growth is new markets, where we are in Mexico and in Colombia. In both markets, we started with a credit card first. Both are growing very well. In Mexico, we have just become the largest credit card issuer in the market, only about 10 months. So those are the key areas of growth for the next for the next few years.
You have a pretty fascinating story yourself, Davin. Correct me if I have this wrong. So you moved to Costa Rica at the age of 9. You were working your dad's button company at the age of 12. I mean, why do you think your path led you into banking?
It's a great question. Nothing to do with between buttons and banking. I think partly was just the entrepreneurship culture that I grew up with. It was not a big business, but I worked with my dad very, very early on, seeing him start a business, seeing all the good times that creates, seeing all the challenges that creates, and the good times and bad times, generating a lot of kind of resilience. And I grew up just hearing that the path to do was to start your own business, that you should not have a boss, that you should own your own destiny. So that was sort of what the radar was looking for as I was able to go to school and ultimately ending up in financial services in New York. But ultimately, that drove me back to entrepreneurship. I felt that I needed to start something, and that opportunity sort of presented itself inside a banking branch in Brazil when I was there after I had just moved to try to open a bank account, and I could not understand why that experience had to be so painful. I talked to all my friends in Brazil, said, forget it. You're a foreigner. No foreigner comes here and competes with a big bank. Banks have been bad. They always will be, and there's nothing you can do. But I had to try, right? Because of that culture of entrepreneurship, I had to give it a shot and was very lucky to find a really, really phenomenal team and you know, the rest of history. We've been able to grow very fast over the past 8 years.
And now you're, David, now you're dad with, what, 4 kids. And you also signed the giving pledge. You know, what message did you want to send to them by signing that pledge?
Yeah, so listen, I mean, Latin America is a region of the world with a lot of income inequality, and technology is creating huge opportunities for entrepreneurs to create great companies. Ultimately, I think what we wanted to do was to just make sure to lead and pledge to give back all of the wealth that, having had the luck of building this business, send it back to the economies and the communities where we've been able to grow, try to invest in education, try to invest in healthcare, and ultimately improving the lives of so many people in Latin America that haven't really had the chance or the luxury that sometimes we had. So part of what my wife and I wanted to do was obviously invest the next decades of our life doing really exciting entrepreneurship opportunities that helps people a lot, but at the same time start creating a bit of an example around Latin American entrepreneurs to give more and see philanthropy as a really exciting endeavor.
Well, we look forward to following your story and the company's story. Nubank founder and CEO David Velez, enjoy the rest of the day. I'm sure very exciting.
Let's bring in an executive who was one of those who testified before the House Financial Services Committee yesterday. We got Paxos co-founder and CEO Charles Cascarilla joining us. Charles, you know, we heard you say yesterday that we need clear standards and the government support to create new, more secure, competitive financial systems. Based on the testimony yesterday, your conversations with lawmakers, how confident are you that they have the understanding and the knowledge to create a new framework?
Well, I think the first thing to take away from yesterday is the conversation was actually very constructive. And I think that the lawmakers are really in a listen and learn mode. And I think they were really trying to do that. If you really suffered through all 5 hours of that. It was a long day for everybody, but I think it was also really important to be able to sit here and talk through these issues because they're complex. And it was a wide-ranging conversation. And I think that as the lawmakers really become more understanding of what's going on in the industry, there's a recognition that while there's uneven regulatory application of different rules, there needs to be a standard that is created that creates a more level playing field for everybody. And I think that was maybe the important takeaway here is everyone wants there to be the right level of regulation. How do you strike that right balance? How do you do it in a way that makes the U.S. stay competitive in what is a really emerging and important industry?
Yeah, the piece on staying competitive was pretty interesting, too, because it seemed like a lot of lawmakers had to ask that about stablecoins and what it might mean for the dominance of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. We heard your compatriot there, I guess, at Circle with USDC talking about that, too, and Jeremy Allaire's response to one of those questions about China's CBDC and what the U.S. could be working on. Just want to play again for our viewers what he said yesterday and get your take to expand on it. Take a listen.
Dollar stablecoins are doing trillions of dollars of transactions. The experimental beta of a Chinese yuan, which is government controlled in China, has done $10 billion of transactions. So the United States is winning. This has the potential to grow at a very significant speed around the world and benefit the US dollar and benefit American businesses and households. And so I think that's one really, really critical thing to understand. And I think the primacy of this infrastructure and the development of this infrastructure, it is a strategic national security and national economic priority for the United States, and we need to get going on it right now.
What's interesting is, I mean, both you and him talked about wanting to stick with using the dollar and dollar-backed currencies here and what you guys offer, but you also got pressure from Chairwoman Waters about your partnership with Meta in rolling out your stablecoin on their digital wallet. So, I mean, how do you kind of square those things if regulators are kind of in both camps here, but overall it seems like a net positive to roll these stablecoins out to a more global user base?
Well, I think one way to frame this is thinking of money as a product. And maybe we don't always do that because it's so ubiquitous and we all use it every single day, but it really is a product. And if you think of it as a product, is it meeting the needs of users? Is it meeting the needs of the economy as it continues to shift and become much more digital? And I think the answer is no. And that's what stablecoins are providing, is a way of having money have different properties, become a different product, adapt to new technology. And this is an important shift that's happening. And if the dollar is not able to respond to this new technology, to the new needs of users, then someone else will, something else will. And that, by the way, could be crypto, that could be the Chinese digital yuan. And so it's crucial for the US dollar to be able to meet these changing needs. And if it does, I think it actually is likely to increase its ubiquity even more, because the reality is people want dollars, not just digitally in the US, but they want them all over the world. Anywhere you go, people want to use the U.S. dollar. They're using physical currency. They can't get bank accounts, or maybe they have to go use crypto because they can't get dollars. And if you can get them and you can use them ubiquitously and very simply, like you can when they're tokenized, it really will actually change the position of the U.S. dollar for a real positive. But, keeping that reserve currency position is something that's also going to depend on regulation. So if we get it right, I think this is a huge opportunity for the U.S. and for the dollar. If we don't get it right, it could be a real huge problem. An innovator's dilemma is something that doesn't just exist for companies. It also exists for currencies as well. And we need to meet that challenge.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess in terms of regulations around it, too, you've got banks maybe not so excited about the idea of new companies like yours coming in here and maybe more directly giving access to those outside the United States, the ability to interact with dollars through stable coins. Is there a concern there maybe too? It didn't seem like it when we were listening into this hearing that maybe regulators, congressmen and women as well, might be more influenced by big banks just kind of given the relationship there in the past. I mean, what's your takeaway there maybe in terms of how surprisingly friendly they were towards you versus maybe how they've reacted to big banks in the past?
Well, I think that was an important takeaway, is that the lawmakers are really constructive. They're really trying to learn and understand. You go on for 5 hours, you could pick one moment or here or there where maybe there was some hard questioning. But I think that was very constructive overall. And I think that this is about an understanding that, like with the internet, nobody wants to be on the wrong side of the internet. No one wants to be on the wrong side of Web3. No one wants to be on the wrong side of innovation, because we've seen so many times over our country's history that by embracing innovation, embracing change, it actually puts us in a position of strength, and it puts us in a position to create new industries, create new jobs, and maintain our lead in emerging industries. And the fact is, in financial industry, in capital markets, in the reserve currency, the U.S. has the lead. And you know, we need to meet that challenge of staying in that position by adopting new technologies. I think that is a lot of what the hearing was about. And so there's more to be done. The dialogue was, I think, very fruitful, but it's going to be something that you're not going to get through in one hearing. I think there's going to be a lot more of this. And the presidential working group paper was another example, and there'll be more to come.
Charles, there's a question about how quickly that regulation, the guardrails, should come. And you heard Jen just pointing to some analysts who say there's no real sense of urgency, at least on the part of lawmakers. And I wonder how you think about the timing of this. Is it better for the regulations to come first in order to understand what the guardrails are? Or does regulation too soon really risk stifling the growth that we're seeing in this space?
Well, you know, smart regulation is, I think, something everyone can agree on. What that means is something that you have to dive into a little bit more. I would maybe approach it from a couple angles here. The first is, as Representative McHenry said, first, do no harm. So let's figure out a way to not over-engineer a solution to an industry that's still very nascent. It's growing, it's bigger, but it's still small. And I don't think that at the moment, it's systemically important. And so you want to be able to allow innovation to happen. The second thing is, there is some clarifications that could happen. And I think this was widely talked about yesterday, how to understand what is certain types of assets. Is it a security? Is it a currency? Is it something else? Is it property? And so what would be the right regulatory regime? What's the right definitions? And that could be very helpful. I also think that the Federal Reserve could potentially open up access to non-bank payment companies, like the Bank of England has done and other countries have done. Mr. Brooks talked about this yesterday, and I think it was a really good point. We talked about in our testimony as well. You know, you could open up the payment systems to non-bank companies and still really keep a lot of safety and soundness. And I think those are steps the regulators could take that would be very constructive. And it could be that there needs to be legislation, but I think that we shouldn't rush to legislate something until we understand it more and until it develops more. If you do that very early, you know, it means you have to do a lot of prognostication in the legislation process. And that's not always easy to do.
Well, Charles, we'd love to have you back on the show as we see these conversations unfold. Charles Cascarilla, Paxos co-founder and CEO, appreciate the time today. I want to get your take on the real estate market. As always, you've got a good eye to the ground of what's happening. We got this report out from Redfin that points to sales hitting an all-time low, but we're looking at the number of homes for sale at an all-time low. I will tell you, as somebody who has been looking, it was incredibly depressing over the last week to see the amount of inventory. And you go from open house to open house, a caravan of people coming in trying to compete. Are we at the peak, you think? Are things going to start to slow down next year?
I'd like to say we're at the peak, or at least promise a slowdown. But no, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better if you're a buyer. Or better before it gets worse if you're the lucky home seller. But, you know, homes in November always go down, the quantity of homes, but they went down 23%. I've never seen that happen before. I've noted that on those homes that sold in the month, they sold in a week or less. Think about that. That's bizarre. The housing market was bonkers. Now it's still nuts and it's getting worse. But of all the shortages affecting our economy, I'm sad to report that I think the housing shortage is going to last the longest. I don't think you're going to have better luck shopping for your home next year. I just don't think so. Unless we increase interest rates by 3-4% overnight, boom, that would drop the market. But anything short of that isn't going to make a difference. Come live with me. It's okay. I'll sleep with you.
3 to 4%, the number to watch there then too. I mean, it's not just home sales too though, Barbara, when we're talking about all-time low in supply, but also when you look at the rental market, that's another one where historically winter is kind of the one area of the year where you start to get some breaks. I was out in that market. Kiko might be looking to buy, but I was renting. We've seen rents, according to that same report, jump about 14% year over year, which is wild to think about too. So, I mean, how does that market look in relation to maybe buying, just kind of given you got Omicron to worry about now too. And so I don't know what's up and what's down in buying versus renting.
You know, if you're expecting rental prices go down, you're mistaken, because what happens is when people are priced out of a purchase market, what do? They fall back on rentals, even if they really want to buy. So no, the rental market, if you wanted to save money, we had a slight opportunity, it lasted about 3 to 4 months, and it was about 8 to 9 months ago. After that, it closed up, and believe me, I'm a landlord. The landlords are making up for lost time. Whatever they shortchanged in those 6 months, like, oh, I'm going to take advantage that I have three people who want this apartment. You have the long lines on both buying an apartment or a home, and you have the long lines on renting a home or an apartment as well.
I mean, that sounds pretty different.
Well, what are your options? You could live in a tent, I guess, but even those prices are going up from what I hear. Sorry, I don't.
Well, I was going to say, Barbara, I mean, you're looking at both sides of the coin, right? Zach just renting. Yep. I'm looking to buy. It sounds like you're saying neither is going to improve. I mean, do we just stay put?
You could stay put, because if you're in some kind of a regulatory environment, which we have in New York and a few other states, you're regulated as to not to be priced out of your rental, for example. There's just a so much increase a landlord could ask for. But anything short of that, no, it's open game. I mean, you know what? The best thing to do is to both of you change jobs immediately and ask for a lot more money from the next employer. And then you could afford to get whatever you want.
Yeah, it's good advice. It's good advice here, Barbara, actually. It hits close to home. When we're talking about maybe the other things out there, we've talked a lot about real estate bubbles, right? But, you know, there's other sectors of the market some people might be playing. I know your co-host, Kevin O'Leary, and I have chatted many a time on crypto. I'm curious if you've started to look at that space at all, just kind of given some of the crazy returns we've seen this year, if you've maybe started to diversify maybe a little bit more away from real estate because of the price increases we've seen. How have you been maybe looking at that?
Well, I've migrated, maybe that's not the right word. I've taken a lot of money out of real estate in New York because I think it's priced so terribly high as an investment right now. And I've looked for other smaller cities to invest in. Right now, I've invested a lot of money in Pittsburgh because Pittsburgh is like the perfect storm right now. It's got a friendly government. It's got the most educated working force in America. And it has big business moving in there, specifically technology businesses. And prices are deflated. They shouldn't be. They're catching up, but you can make a lot of money. So I'm looking, I love real estate. You can't ask me to take it out of real estate, but I did. Well, that's real estate too. I did invest in Zillow. Remember you asked me last time, you're going to invest in Zillow? They just crashed. I did, and I've lost 2 points so far, but I know I'm going to make a fortune. I know I'm going to make a fortune if I just hang on there, maybe another 3-4 months. I think they're doing better than everybody expected. But where do I invest? Where do I take my money out? I'm so sorry to say I love real estate. I trust real estate. It's a very, very slow way to get very, very rich. I like
that. You play what you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. And that's why we love having you on. Barbara Corcoran with the latest there. Buying the dip on Zillow. Respect it. Appreciate you coming on here to chat with us again.
Pleasure.
Then we'll chat soon. Barbara Corcoran, the host of ABC's Shark Tank.
As if companies don't have enough to deal with during the pandemic, social media remains a hotbed of activity companies must manage around the clock. One customer complaint could snowball and on social media. And before you know it, a boycott the brand hashtag is in fact trending. Let's check in one company trying to mitigate these risks for very large companies. Raji Thomas is the founder and CEO of Sprinklr. Raji, good to see you again. It's been some time. So we're almost in the new year. What are companies telling you is their biggest challenge they're dealing with at this point in the pandemic?
Brian, good to see you too. Thank you for the opportunity. What we're hearing from customers consistently is, you know, especially with COVID, they're all going through their own digital transformation. And what are they transforming into? What we're seeing is they're transforming into customer-centric companies. They're shifting away from being brand or product-centric, and they're shifting to being customer-centric, and doing that using digital capabilities across channels. And that's what we're hearing from all of our customers and the companies that we talk to.
Hey, Raji, it's Brian Chung here. Can you explain to us exactly how you do that? How do you fit into the ecosystem here? Because it's kind of factored into the stock ticker as well, right? CXM, customer experience management. But what exactly does that involve when you interact with your client and say, here's how we can help you do that and execute?
Great question. You know, Brian, just look at our, like each one of our own behavior. We spend a lot of time on the Facebook and the Twitter and the WhatsApp and the WeChat and the Google Message and the Apple iMessage, and like all of those, a lot more than we used to, right? We're not watching TV as much. We're not writing emails as much on a personal context. What we do is provide a unified platform for large companies to do all their customer-facing functions, everything from customer care to marketing and advertising, across 36 modern digital channels. So that's all social channels, all messaging channels. And now we're going backwards and adding text and live chat. And we just added voice. And Honda Japan went live on Sprinklr with voice. So that's really the powerful idea here. One unified platform to do everything from care to marketing across 36 channels. And that's a big, that's like a big thing if you're a large company.
Raji, it's Julie here. You guys just came out with these numbers that beat estimates. As we talked about, your forecast for revenue also ahead of estimates. I'm curious about the profitability side of the equation. You guys just came public, I believe in June, right? And so you're a newly public company. You're posting losses like many other newly public companies. But I'm just curious what the trajectory looks like to a goal of profitability.
Absolutely. Great question, Julie. We were cash flow positive last year and year before. We have proven over and over again that we have the ability to pull back and make the company profitable. And we've done that when we thought that was the right thing to do. The right thing to do right now for us is to invest in growth. We see this as a 20, 30 year run. Julie, if you ask any CIO or CMO, CDO, or even a CEO of a large global company, and we target about 100,000 companies around the world, those guys, and ask them to think about their customer-facing technology stack, and it's very complex. And you're going to inevitably find that they've got a corporate IT team that has built a ton of stuff. You're going to inevitably find that they're either using Salesforce or Microsoft for CRM. You're going to find that they are now standardizing maybe on Adobe. And they still got a chunk of mishmash point solutions. And ask them who among the existing crop of next generation companies has a shot at being the third or fourth platform. Because this is huge. You know how big these other companies are. And they need a third or fourth platform. And Sprinklr is quickly becoming that third or fourth enterprise customer-facing platform that works with the Salesforce, Adobes, and the Microsofts and gets them 80, 90% of the way there with consolidation. So we think that this is a long-term play. We think that we should be investing more for our investors and our shareholders. The right thing is to double down, grab market share.
Raji, do you have any teams working internally on the metaverse? Because the way I'm thinking about it right now, and again, you know, this is real time, I'm in the metaverse, maybe Brian Chung tweets me something I don't like. You know, I wish somebody would flag that to me.
Great question, Brian. Look, we are bullish on the vision that Facebook has laid out and the whole concept of AR, VR, and how it can change customer-facing functions. However, what we think large companies need today is a channel agnostic way to do their business. You can't say I'm going to deal with you differently on the phone than if you are texting me or you're FaceTiming me. So our approach has been, how do we create an omni-channel ability so I can be in the metaverse, maybe jump back and text you or email you or live chat with you. And that's the infrastructure that we have been building for 12 years. So the metaverse is not here and now. It's coming. It's got a lot of promise. But what enterprises should do now is get a channel agnostic ability to sell and market and run advertising and to do customer care. And that's the foundation we help them lay.
Well, I should clarify that Brian Chung only tweets me nice things. We'll leave it there for now. Raji Thomas, founder and CEO of Sprinklr. Always good to see you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Brian. You too.